Good morning. It is 10:01, Wednesday, November 11th. This is the TDN Writers Room presented by Keeneland. My name is Joe Bianca. I'm the associate editor of the Thoroughbred Daily News, still on cloud nine after this weekend's results. I'm talking, of course, about the Jets finding a way to lose and get one game closer to Trevor Lawrence.
And hi, I'm Bill Finley, a correspondent for the Thoroughbred Daily News.
Jonathan Green, general manager for DJ Stable. And I want to shout out to my beautiful wife, Michelle. We'll be celebrating 27 years of marriage on Friday.
Marital bliss. You meant to say that, right?
That's already an assumption, yes.
That's inherent, implicit. I'm Alan Carrasco, managing editor of TDN. And after Friday and Saturday, I now know a little bit what it feels like to be zippy chippy.
The TDN Writers Room was presented by Keeneland. Keeneland just wrapped up the Breeders' Cup World Championships. Great weekend of racing, obviously. It was a beautiful, beautiful weekend. Great weather, great track surfaces, and just it looked great on television. So congrats to everybody for pulling that off. It was obviously a very difficult year to pull off any major event. So shout out to them and everybody at Keeneland for getting that done and presenting it so well to the world. Also, Keeneland November started on Monday. Seems to be going pretty swimmingly. Third day today, second session of book two going on as we speak. I believe it's just kicking off right now. So we've got that through November 18th. I'm sure John is poking around down there in Lexington, seeing what's what. So best of luck to everybody at Keeneland for the rest of this sale. And then maybe you guys can take a breath, at least until Keeneland January. So we are done with the Breeders' Cup, and it's going to be harder and harder to come up with content as the season moves into the winter. However, this week is not the case because we had a fantastic, remarkable weekend of racing, great performances all around. We're going to get to most of it, but we should start at the top with the Breeders' Cup Classic. Authentic, it was one of my few good opinions on the weekend. He was 6-1 morning line, crept down a little bit to 4-1, but still I thought pretty good value, went wire to wire just as he did in the Kentucky Derby. Lots to talk about that race. He has been retired to Spendthrift, obviously a little disappointing with the way he's going right now. He got a 111 buyer in the Classic, so I mean he probably would have blossomed even further as a four-year-old. Would have loved to see that, but it is what it is. He's a son of Into Mischief. He's extremely valuable right now, so I understand the decision, even if it's a little bit disappointing not to get to see him. Improbable, I thought, ran a really good race considering the pace and considering how wide he was on the far turn. I thought that was a really good effort, and he's going to Windstar now. He's an interesting sire as well, one of the last really good sons of City Zip. Big controversy around, not big controversy, but some controversy around Tiz La Law, who ran fifth in the race. Barkley Tag was throwing Manny Franco under the bus, which not a great look to me. When Manny's ridden this horse kind of perfectly his entire career, and yeah, now all of a sudden you want to blame him for the horse losing. I thought basically he ran the race that he ran in every single race except the Travers. I just thought we said before the race that only his Travers was probably good enough to win the race. Every other race was not, and I think that's what happened. He was a little rank. I think Manny did make one mistake when Maximum Security was not ridden aggressively. He had a chance on the backstretch to get into the two path, I think, and stalk Authentic from there, but. There's no guarantee he was going to run by Authentic regardless. He didn't do it in the Derby. So a little classless to throw Manny under the bus there. But Phil was reporting yesterday that there might be a new rider for him in the Pegasus. He will see as a four-year-old. So that's good news. But let's just get the general impressions from the Classic, and then we'll go on to the other races. Start with Bill.
Yeah, I mean, a lot to go over there, Joe. And first of all, I mean, Authentic was the best horse. There's no other way to say it. He was the best horse in Breeders' Cup Day. You can look back on the year now and say he was the best horse and the deserving horse of the year. The only thing about the race is that I don't know that he needed to have everything his own way, but he did have everything his own way. I know there's some problems with the timing, and I finally found on the trackage charts what the pace was. 23.20, 47.06, 110.84. That's not crawling. But when a good horse can get out front with really not a lot of pace pressure in reasonable fractions like that, that is a big advantage. But again, I don't want to take anything away from him. I mean, he was a horse that earlier in the year, myself and a lot of other people didn't really think he'd go a mile and a quarter. Now he's won the Derby at a mile and a quarter and the Classic at a mile and a quarter. Obviously disappointed to see him be retired, but not a surprise. This is what is going to happen with virtually every good three-year-old who's going to go on to a worthy stallion career. On the Manny Franco thing, I think Manny, in some respects, was on thin ice to begin with, because no fault of his own. But if you think of the top five, six, seven riders in the country, you don't think of Manny Franco. He doesn't have that kind of experience in big races like a John Velasquez does, or a Mike Smith, or Javier Castellano, or the Ortiz brothers. So, you know, maybe all along, you know, they were kind of looking for an excuse to take him off. I don't really have any great problems with his ride, but look, it's like a baseball team. When they underperform, they fire the manager. The manager didn't hit 185 and have a 6.24 ERA, but, you know, you make a change for the sake of change. Other topic you talked about was improbable. And I, you know, for what it's worth, but it's fun to look at the track as charts. And he ran 6,715 feet, or Authentic went 6,648 feet. And they boil it down to a number of what the average miles per hour was. And Probable was the fastest horse, 38.1 to 37.8. But at the end of the day, they don't pay you for being the fastest on trackers charts.
Yeah, and you know, overall, the race gave us everything we wanted. It was a great field. It was heavy competition. You know, there were a lot of betting options. And plus, it gave us yet another jockey trainer controversy, another teletimer issue, and another horse being retired at the top of the game. Ironically enough, I was reading on Twitter and other social media that Authentic's win, you know, obviously has, you know, triggered another bonus that's going to go to the owners from myracehorse.com to Spendthrift. The fact that now that win probably certainly made him three-year-old of the year, but probably made him horse of the year, is also going to trigger two other bonuses from the .com group to the parent owner of Spendthrift. So it's wonderful for myracehorse.com owners to be able to say they had the Kentucky Derby winner, they had the Breeders' Cup winner, they had three-year-old of the year, horse of the year, but it still costs you money. So I don't know if that was necessarily the end game for micro share owners in this business, but I think that's still a work in progress as far as whether or not that model is going to work here in the States. But overall, I thought that, you tipped the cap to Authentic for his win. He certainly ran the best race. Again, you can argue that maybe he had the easiest path to victory. Doesn't matter. He took it and he won it. And looks like that he's going to walk away with a lot of hardware. And the only thing I can say is that he's gone too soon, because he's the horse that we ignored and kind of didn't even talk about for most of the year. And then the last two races, he's, you know, really stepped his game up and showed why he should be 3-year-old of the year, maybe even horse of the year.
I'm going to lobby for a little bit of a kicker to my Derby winning contest now that we've added the Breeders' Cup Classic. Joe, I'll let you work on that, okay?
You get bonus points, Al?
Yeah, bonus points, dollars. I'm wide open. I tweeted out the race and it basically handed him the race. I mean, looking at that race on paper with Global Campaign, Authentic, Maximum Security, and Improbable all lined up next to each other, you had to think that the pace was going to be, was definitely going to be on. And I didn't see him getting clear the way he did. And, you know, Improbable was five or six wide, four or five wide. But they let, you know, they let Authentic lob along. So, the pace was good, was fast enough. But 110 and four on that track, the way the track was playing all weekend, was more akin to 111 and four, maybe 112 or something like that. They basically let him just get out there and walk the dog. And nobody really had a chance. When Maximum Security didn't go, Improbable did what he could with covering all that ground, but it was just a task too tall. And as far as the Franco thing goes, I really think he's being made the fall guy. I mean, he rode that horse, like Joe said, he's ridden that horse perfectly. He's ridden it perfectly at Gulfstream, at Belmont, at Saratoga, and led her perfect rides. And you know, he was tons the best in those races, and he wasn't facing the competition in those races that he was the other day. I think I said last week, there were no Caracaros in the Breeders' Cup Classic, but I mean, let's be fair. I mean, he broke, he could have gone for the lead. Maybe he could have been ridden a little more aggressively down the back, but I mean, he set a boxy trip and then was empty at the 3/8. So on the day he wasn't good enough. I mean, that's my opinion. I don't think it was any fault of the rider. And I do. I agree with you, Joe. I think it's a bad look to sort of throw him under the bus. No pun intended.
Lots. That's pretty good. Yeah, I mean, lots of bad looks for Barkley Tag in the last couple of months. But it's interesting how their fates diverged. Since the Derby. I mean, Tinsella was the presumptive 3-year-old champion, maybe horse of the year going into the Derby, heaviest Derby favorite in decades. Authentic had been completely forgotten. He was Baffert's B team. He somehow got downgraded by us and the rest of the racing fans when he won the Haskell. And then since then, they've gone in completely different directions. Authentic beats him in the Derby. Tinsella passes on the Preakness. Authentic runs second in the Preakness, but huge, huge effort. No disgrace losing that race to Swiss Guide ever. And then, you know, they decide to train Tinsella up to the Classic, and he runs fifth, and Authentic wins and gets 3-year-old and Horse of the Year right out from under them. So it's been an interesting couple of months, you know, in terms of the topsy-turviness of the 3-year-old division. Looking at John now, see if he heard that. All right,
I got it.
That's why these seasons are as long as they are, and why it is such an accomplishment to win Horse of the Year or 3-year-old champion, because there are so many twists and turns, especially in a year like this, obviously with the Derby and the Preakness being so late in the season. So Al mentioned the track. That's something I want to get to a little bit, and how many track records were being set. This was something that I felt like used to happen at Santa Anita back in the day when Santa Anita was hosting the Breeders' Cup, and they were just blazing up the track. It was basically a highway. And I think they did the opposite of that last year because of all the horse deaths. They slowed down the track to kind of a crazy amount where they were going the mile in 136 and 137. So but that was a little interesting, and kind of, I'm not going to say it diminishes the accomplishments of the Breeders' Cup winners, but it loses its luster a little bit when track records are being set pretty much every other race. But I wanted to move on to some of the other races on Saturday's card. The turf was I think the story was Dermot Weld getting his long awaited first Breeders' Cup winner. Obviously a legendary trainer over in Europe, and Tarnawa was just, I thought she was really scintillating in that race. She had such a huge kick. I mean, the pace wasn't that fast. Channelmaker did stick around and hang around for third. I thought he was pretty much the best U.S. hope, and that bore out. I thought Magical didn't look too comfortable throughout that race, and still was able to get up for second. She always shows up, but Tarnawa is a really, really nice, really interesting horse. And then the Distaff, you know, Monomoy Girl, she's never going to be the figure maker's darling. She's never going to run that 110 plus buyer, and she's never going to do, you know, she's never going to have that kind of, you know, brilliant win, but she just shows up every single time, no matter what the post is, no matter what the pace scenario is. And to me, that's one of the marks of true greatness. It's easy to run, not easy, but it's easier to just run one or two big races when everything is your own way, either on the front end or you get a pace set up. But she just, it doesn't matter to her. Like she's gone wire to wire. She's stuck the pace. She's come from well out of it. She's overcome wide posts over and over again. And, you know, she's the kind of horse I'll never love to bet at even money. And I was against her on Saturday, but at the end of the day, you just got to tip your cap. And we're going to talk to Brad Cox a little bit later. She also sold on Sunday for $9.5 million at Facing November. We'll get to that as well. But I was just wondering if you guys had any thoughts about the Distaff or the turf.
Yeah, Joe, I'll tackle the turf. And yeah, I mean, Monomoy Girl is just fantastic. If you think about it, if you can project forward, I would say that she's probably the only horse on the Breeders' Cup card that's going to make the Hall of Fame. And I don't think Authentic has done enough. And it's hard for a horse to do Hall of Fame worthiness if they're just going to run through their 3-year-old career. She's a slam dunk Hall of Famer. And it's really exciting that they're going to run her next year. And I would like to see if Brad Cox has any answers to these questions yet. But I'm wondering if they're going to get a little more adventurous about her campaign. I mean, if they're just going to run her four times and point for the Breeders' Cup Distaff, well, it'd be great to have her back. But that's not really, you know, something that's really going to spice up the season for her. You know, why not big races against males or something like that? We'll see what the answer there. The one disappointment, of course, with the Distaff, it happened again when we were expecting this great showdown between Swiss Skydiver and Monomoy Girl, just like we were expecting the Kentucky Oaks, a great showdown between Monomoy Girl, Swiss Skydiver and Gamine. It didn't materialize because Swiss Skydiver stumbled at the start. I don't think she had any chance after that happened. Congratulations to her having a wonderful campaign. She'll be back next year, obviously a three-year-old filly champion, but it was disappointed that she didn't get to run. But, you know, you can't say, even John Green has to say good things about Monomoy Girl at this point.
Yeah, I don't know where I became the poster child for saying, for crapping on Monomoy Girl. I never said the filly herself was a problem.
Because, John, you ripped her when she came back and won that allowance race.
No, I didn't. You go back in time, and you'll see. I never ripped her. Anyway, that being said, Monomoy Girl ran a phenomenal race. And, you know, Bill, I never even thought about it that way as far as of the 100-and-something competitors on Saturday that were racing, that Monomoy Girl may be the only Hall of Famer. That's a very interesting thought. And you're right. And quite frankly, that should be the percentage of what gets into the Hall of Fame is, you know, of all the horses in the world, there should only be a handful every couple of years they get in. But Monomoy Girl proved that she was the best. Ran her race. Swiss Skydiver, you know, unfortunately, you know, had a problem at the start and never really, you know, was in the race after that. And you also have to wonder if all the miles that Swiss Skydiver ran and flew and van throughout the year, if that ultimately, you know, had something to do with her lackluster performance in the distaff. You know, we called it on the show, the Monomoy Girl Valiance Exacta Box, you know, Exacta, which was really good. And I was glad to see that it came to fruition. I was also excited on the turf race for Turnawa and for Magical, but for a different reason. I was more excited about those two finishing first and second in the race because they beat the boys. And that's just very exciting to me to see horses go out of their comfort zone and run in races that they normally wouldn't run. And we talked about Swiss Skydiver, you know, doing that against the boys, you know, and hailing Ken McPeak, rightfully so, for taking that that chance. But here's another example of fillies that not only, you know, won, but really kind of dominated the group overall, you know, for the turf racing here in the States. So I was pleased to see that combination come in first and second, you know, for those reasons. And Joe, to go back to what you were saying about the track records, you know, you're 100% right. It did remind me of Santa Anita from years ago when it was just, you know, a parking lot and they would run on it. The only difference, though, this year was that there were, at Keeneland, there were five track records. But the other important number to me is the fact that in none of the Breeders' Cup races, was there a breakdown. So there were five track records in Breeders' Cup races and no breakdowns in any of the Breeders' Cup races. And as an industry where we're going to be on national television, that's what you want to see. You want to make sure that you see, you know, fast racing, safe racing, and no ambulances, you know, picking up horses or jockeys.
Like, Joe, I'm with you on Monomoy Girl. She's something I just always take on at low prices. But, I mean, considering what she's done, yeah, I think you said it perfectly. She's versatile. She can be on the pace. She can be off the pace. And, I mean, in the Oaks, she overcame a wide draw, did so again in the 2018 distaff, and did so again the other day. You know, you watch her in transit, and you say, boy, she's going to have to be good to do it from out there. And then she just does it. She just gets it done every time. So Bill's right. She's a slam dunk, first ballot Hall of Famer. And really, I mean, it's a pleasure to see performances like that. And she joins a select few horses that have won back-to-back Breeders' Cup distaffs, Biakoa and Royal Delta. So that's a pretty good company to be in. And I love watching the turf. Of course, John, 2 years ago, it was Enable over Magical at Churchill, so we saw the Phillies win go 1-2 before. But for me, it's fun to see, because those races, the way that they're run, slow early and fast late, and sit sprint, like we like to call it, and that kind of style is always going to suit a European runner. But to see the way Turnawa was ridden, just switched off back there really for a mile and a quarter. And then Colin Keane, like, he knew what he had under her. And as soon as he hit the gas, she just took off. And unfortunately, there's not a mile and a quarter split on track as to see just how fast she was to come home, but her final half was something like 46-2 or something like that. So she was really, really motoring, and good for Dermot Well, but that's one sort of statistical anomaly that needed to be fixed. And he's a trainer that deserves to be on a Breeders' Cup Roll of Honor. So good for, you know, good for those connections.
Yeah, she's a big time monster for sure. The thing with the Monomoy girl is, like, also, I don't know, this is just my impression, is that she's not the prettiest mover either. Like, I've never thought that she's great to look at when she's running, but she's a war horse, and that's, you know, she's going to deserve her Hall of Fame plaque. And she's, you know, she's been campaigned pretty excellently and, you know, pretty ballsy. I agree with Bill that it would be nice to see her take on males next year and do something out of the box, but just even to bring her back as a 5-year-old and now as a 6-year-old, I mean, that's kind of the opposite of Authentic retiring 2 seconds after the Breeders' Cup Classic. I think that's what we're looking for in our racehorses these days, and we don't see it that much. So I think a tip of the cap is warranted there. Just going elsewhere on Saturday before we move on to a couple of Friday's observations. Obviously, the two biggest performances outside of the races that we've spoken about are Gamine and Nixco. And Gamine, I was against, so I was wrong about that. We're going to get to where I was right, where I was very, very right. But Gamine, but she was. I thought it was a step up for her, not just because she ran so brilliant, she ran a 110 buyer, and because she won so powerfully, but because she was just able to switch off so easily. You know, she got beat to the punch by Serengeti Empress, and I thought, being inside of Serengeti Empress, that she would get a little rank and try to fight Johnny and not be comfortable. But that wasn't the case at all. She settled very beautifully and just switched out of, outside of Serengeti Empress. Pace was pretty fast, and she just blew away Serengeti Empress in the stretch. I thought that was incredible. Obviously, she has there are, you know, mixed feelings about her with the positive tests that she's had this year. But I mean, you know, it is what it is. She still has run these brilliant races, and as far as I know, has not tested positive in any of these monster races. It's just that some of these other lesser races that she's tested positive for, I don't know what that says. And then Nixco, who has just been completely reborn under Brad Cox, and that was a quick pace as well. Complexity took it to him from the jump, and I was really surprised at the way that race was bet. Complexity was 9-2. I figured he would be much shorter than that, even if he wasn't the favorite. And Nixco got all the money at 9-5, and just, you know, never looked like a loser, and seems to me to be clearly the best dirt miler in the country right now. It'll be interesting to see where he goes from here, son of a painter. But any other thoughts from you guys on Saturday's races?
Yeah, I mean, I second everything you said about Gamine. And one of the ironies is the two races where she tested, allegedly tested positive, I guess you should say, this year, were two of her poorer performances. The Kentucky Oaks and the allowance race at Oakland, where she just barely beat Speech. But that also says to the fact that she's just a totally different horse around two turns. I've never quite seen a horse that is so good at doing one thing and is, you know, not nearly as good doing something else. I mean, she was just incredible, an explosive performance to win by 6.25. Also, you know, she didn't get the greatest trip because I still think this is a horse that really wants to be on the lead. She had to wind up chasing Serengeti Empress. Very good ride by John Velasquez, who had a great day with his ride, of course, on Authentic as well. So, you know, Gamine wins for Baffert. Nixco, you know, right now, I mean, Brad Cox has his horse as good as any horse is in the country. I mean, you know, you can translate his mile performance into the 1.25. I guess he doesn't want to go 1.25, but can almost make a case that he was every bit as good as Authentic. Joe, I want to bring up another thing too, while we're talking about these, and maybe some other people can weigh in on this. Gamine was one of the five track records set over the 2 days, her track record for 7 furlongs. But I don't think there was a bias. The track was obviously very fast, but horses were winning on the front. Horses were winning coming off the pace. You didn't have to necessarily be inside or outside. So I just want to throw that out for further discussion, people. And I think that's the most important thing. A fast track is one thing, but as long as it's a fair track, I don't think people have a right to complain too much about it.
Yeah. And
I'll take this. I was going here next. I guess where I've gotten to is that I'm not sure that I think that the track was biased, and I'm not sure how much different what I'm going to say is from bias, but I thought the track was so speedy and good. Fast horses were winning the race. Gamine's a fast horse. Nashville is a fast horse. Like they were likely winners to begin with, no matter how the track was playing. But I still feel that if it wasn't speed biased, in my mind, it was speed favoring, and that speed was absolutely dominant, meaning that those horses, with the exception of Whitmore, God bless him, those horses who wanted to make a run and make a run from deep, they were going to be up against it on that track. So Belle's the one for me is the best example. She likes to sit back and make that one run, and she was just, and she's rallied into pieces like that before and made a late impact. But the track was carrying speed, in my opinion, so much that a horse like that was pretty much up against it. You know, when I saw the first couple of races on Friday, I started having my doubts about Bell's the One and anything that wanted to make a run like that. So that's just my two cents on it.
Yeah, and to me, Gamine was so obvious that I picked it. So, you know, everyone should have been on board. And I think a lot of people were, because she paid $4. So, but she was definitely the an impressive race, an impressive win. Another horse that, you know, really just has boggled my mind as far as, you know, what is she really? Is she just so lightning fast that that's what carries her to be able to go a mile or further? Or if she should just stick in this lane and just be the dominant sprinter, three-year-old, you know, or should be Philly sprinter in the country, because she's awesome. I mean, that was just an awesome performance by her. Interestingly enough, you know, the three-year-olds that ran well against older horses, if you look back, they were the ones that didn't race a lot in the beginning of the year or had a break at some point during the year. And the ones that had a really tough campaign, Tis the Law, Swiss Skydiver, they kind of faltered in the races, you know, against the older horses for various reasons. But I think part of it also could be the fact that they ran everywhere and they ran all over the place and danced almost every dance. And then it's tough to continually peak in a race like this when after you've had a campaign like that. One of the other races that I thought was really, really cool to watch was the FanDuel Breeders' Cup Mile. And for me, it was really fun to watch, not only because Aidan O'Brien finally broke his schneid. And I think, Bill, you mentioned it last week. What was he, 0 for 50?
0 for 54. And then I think he lost three races on Breeders' Cup Day before the mile. So he'd be going on an 0 for 57 run.
0 for 57. And arguably the best trainer, certainly in Europe, if not in the world. I mean, he has the best of the best and always, you know, campaigns his horses everywhere in the world. And for whatever reason, it's been very elusive. The Breeders' Cup win has been very elusive for him. So not only did he win with 73-1, also eligible, who got lucky and got into the race, Order of Australia, but he finished first, second, and third in the race. So I thought it was really cool that not only a big, you know, Bomb won the race for a horse that probably shouldn't even have been in the race if it wasn't for a scratch. Ran at 70-1, and you look back at Order of Australia's previous race, and I don't even know if he still finished the race. I mean, he lost by 50 lengths practically in that race, so there must have been a big excuse. But they had the wherewithal to bring him over, hope that they would get in. The horse got in, ran from the 15 post, from the 14 post, number 15 in your programs, and won the race. And then Circus Maximus and Aidan O'Brien had a third place finisher in that race also. And to me, that was just really fun, because not only was like the pressure off, the monkey was off his back, but he blew it out in a huge way, not only with a 70-1 shot, but also hitting the trifecta cold with his entries.
I want to segue off of that too. That was the second of two rides from impossible draws for Pierre Charles Boudeau. And I don't think you can understand how difficult it is to carve out a trip the way that he did on Order of Australia. So he got down from that wide draw. He was already down to two or three path by the time they hit the turn and prominent on Order of Australia. It had him in a winning spot from way out there. And then the ride on Audaria in the Philly American Turf was one of the best that I can remember. Again, he was out wide, and Civil Union kind of took back a little bit, and that allowed him to get right in front of her at the fence. You know, sat a little better than midfield, pulled her out in upper stretch, and she just outfinished a very, very game rushing fall, who I was against for the 34th time in her career. But and those were two.
Don't forget about third place finisher.
Help me out here, John.
Bobby's little Goyle.
Big race. Giant race. And for that matter,
Dark is still a possibility.
That's true. To the Hall of Fame for Monomoy Girl and the Ark for Hoy's Little Goyle. You heard
and
it here
Lady,
first.
Lady Prancelot ran a big race to be fourth as well. But Pierre Charles Boudot is an outstanding world-class rider. He won last year's Ark on Valpgeist. So he knows how to perform in a big spot. But those two rides were like off the charts great.
Agreed. And we'll get to Daria and our self-backpatting segment coming up. I just wanted to run down Friday's races real quick. I mean, Golden Pal was pretty impressive. It was like, that was another great 6-5 pick of John's. It was interesting because he looked like, you know, he was going to win by 5-6 lengths until the 16th pole. And then it suddenly looked like he was going to lose, but he was able to hold on. Obviously a pretty fast pace, wide draw. He's incredibly talented. It'll be interesting to see where he goes from here. I'm assuming he's going to make some kind of trip back to Royal Ascot or Europe next year. But elsewhere, Aunt Pearl was just dominant. I mean, that was, she like talking about going fast and keeping on going. She ran them off their feet at every step of the race. And she's incredibly interesting going forward by Lope de Vega, who's, you know, they just announced that he'll be popped up to €125,000 at Ballylinch yesterday. So he's one of the hottest sires in the world right now, along with Wooten Bassett, the sire of Audaria. But in the dirt races, I mean, first of all, let me just mention Juvenile Turf real quick. None of us talked about Fire at Will. And I thought, you know, in retrospect, he was an overlay at 30-1, especially since Public Sector, who I liked, was 6 or 7 to 1. Fire Will beat Public Sector in the Pilgrim. Obviously, the assumption was that Fire Will just cut away with the easy pace in the Pilgrim, but he showed that he can have that fast finishing final quarter mile or so without being on the lead. So in retrospect, probably should have sauced him in, but didn't. But the two big races, the dirt juvenile races, I thought Vquist got a great trip, a great ride by Joel Rosario, another horse who had done her best running on the lead. But you know, she was able to sit off a grade one Breeders' Cup win for Butch Reed. That's pretty cool to see. He had Maximus Mischief last year get hurt. It was probably the horse of a lifetime for him to get to the Triple Crown races, but Vquist looks like she could be a Kentucky Oaks contender. Nyquist, what a year Nyquist has had as a freshman sire. He's just his horses have been off the charts good. In a pretty good freshman sire class, I think he's been able to stand out, him and Not This Time, I think, have been the two standouts so far, at least. And then in the juvenile, you know, we talked about this before the race, and we weren't the only ones, but that this was going to be, even though Jackie's Warrior was a deserving favorite and had been so dazzling through all of his four races, that circumstances were such that it was going to be hard for him to reproduce those races. And that's the way it played out. There was a ton of speed. Pace was very fast. He wasn't up on the pace. He did sit a little bit off of it, but he was close enough that it was taxing for him. And anybody that's downgrading him for running fourth, I think doesn't really know what they're looking at. Now, he may be a one-turn horse in the future. It's definitely possible he's bred to be a one-turn horse, but I wouldn't write off his two-turn chances just because of that race. I just think, you know, he was set up to fail with the pace the way it was. And Essential Quality ran a terrific race. You know, he's interesting because, going back to that versatility thing that I was talking about before with Modern White Girl, is that he seems like a horse who can sit close, who can lay off. Maybe he can go to the lead. I don't know. We haven't seen that yet, but that's what you're looking for, especially with a horse to go a mile and a quarter. And he's the latest best hope for Godolphin to get that elusive Derby win. We thought they had a big chance this year with Baxfield, but that didn't work out. So he's obviously, you know, the leading 2 year old. He's heading into next year as a leading 2 year old. He's going to win champion 2 year old. I think, you know, Jackie's Warrior would have had a shot maybe if there was like a close head and head finish, you know, if he ran second, but he's going to be champion 2 year old. I'm going to talk to Brad Cox again, like I said, but I just want to hear some thoughts from you guys on Friday's Future Stars Friday juvenile races.
If you don't mind, I want to go back to make one last point about Saturday and something John said. And he said, 'tis the law might have been victimized by a long, hard campaign. This is what it's come to. My head wants to explode. Horse ran six times in the year and had 2 months off before the Breeders' Cup Classic. And I'm not saying that to knock John, because I think 99% of the people feel the same way. Oh my God, what a tough campaign he has. I mean, right now, Dr. Fager spinning in his grave when he hears that. But, you know, is that really what it's come to in the sport? And I'm afraid it has. Okay, now I'm going to stop being the old man standing on the lawn yelling at kids to get off my lawn. Joe, to me, obviously, the story on the Friday was essential quality. And, you know, this is a horse where, you know, a lot of Breeders' Cup juvenile winners you could look at and say, boy, I really don't like this horse going forward next year for the Kentucky Derby. I mean, none more so than poor Storm the Court, who has never done a thing since his Breeders' Cup juvenile win last year. But, you know, going forward, what is there not to like about this horse? He's got the breeding. He's got, with apologies to Bob Baffert, the hottest trainer in the sport today. He looks like he can go any distance of ground whatsoever. So I think he's an exciting horse that, you know, is going to be, if he stays healthy, which is always the big if, and after this bruising three-race campaign that he had as a two-year-old, if he can come back after that. But, you know, I think he's a horse that is potentially going to create a lot of excitement next year. And I'm with you. I'm willing to give Jackie's Warrior another chance. He was just so good in those previous races that, you know, I'm not going to write him off yet. But I also agree with you that we may look back in hindsight about this time next year when he's the favorite in the Breeders' Cup Juvenile Sprint and say, well, he's the male version of Gamine. And, you know, the distance was a problem for him. But Essential Quality was very exciting, and look forward to what he's going to do next year.
I'm not even going to touch the old man on the lawn in his nightgown, you know, and sleep cap yelling at the kids. But yeah, that is the modern athlete. And that's the modern athlete for thoroughbreds. And that's the modern athlete for humans also, is that they're not as durable. They're just not as durable. That being said, let's focus on two things, two races. Joe, I'm going to go back to the Breeders' Cup Philly Juvenile Turf and the first four finishers, all Irish bred. You know, they really ran well. There were a lot of horses that came over from overseas that competed and I think showed their worth to the American racing fans. So, you know, kudos to them. And I know we're talking about future Fridays, but we haven't touched on what I think was the most impressive you know, race of the day, of the weekend. And that was Nashville's win in the Perryville. I mean, he literally ran a hole in the wind winning that race. And I know it wasn't great competition. I know in hindsight, I think we even said last week, boy, they really should have run him in the sprint because he, you know, with the defection of a couple of horses and scratch of a couple of horses, he really would have been the favorite. But the way that he ran that race with a 102 buyer and he finished in a 107.4. I mean, that's just outrageous. 107.4 for a lightly raced three-year-old. It was, you know, I remember when Unbridled Song breezed down at the Miami Sale and they said he went so fast that the trees swayed after he went by. That was the hyperbole that I was thinking of when Nashville won that race, being throttled down at the end in 107.4. It was mind-boggling to me how fast and how good that horse looked.
Yeah, I mean, he was definitely did it in a common gallop. I mean, he never looked like he was really, he didn't have to extend himself at all. So it'd be interesting. You'd have to assume that the Malibu is next. And do you want something to look forward to for the next 6 weeks? How about a Charlatan, Nashville, throw in a little Independence Hall in the Malibu, December 26th at Santa Anita?
Can we go on tour? Can the show go on the road?
We should do that. Writer's Room Roadshow.
It's a long enough drive. We could all take turns.
Do it. But just a couple of other observations Friday and the weekend. Golden Palace, son of Uncle Mo, and then Uncle Mo's son, Nyquist, sires Vquist. And that made him just one of 24 stallions in Breeders' Cup history to win a Breeders' Cup race and sire the winner of another, being Uncle Mo. So that was that's a neat accomplishment. And, you know, just looking at the weekend overall, there were a lot of firsts in terms of jockeys and trainers. So Tom Eaves won the turf sprint on glass slippers with excellent ground-saving ride in a race that, candidly, you do need some luck in. But Colin Keane had his first winner. Luis Saez had a deserved first winner. And then among the trainers, you had 3 Euros, James Fanshawe with Audaria. You had Kevin Ryan and Dermot Weld, as we spoke about. So, and then Ron Moquette and Mike Maker with their first Breeders' Cup wins. So, and we really haven't touched upon Whitmore. And I don't have a lot to say other than I bet him last year, and I think I deserve some sort of consolation.
So this is, we're going to move on from the Breeders' Cup, but we wanted to discuss the wagering aspect of it, of how our picks and our insights did last week, because if you got through that hour and a half Breeders' Cup preview, I hope I made it worth it for you with a 17-1 winner in the Philly and Mare turf. That was actually, no, to be honest, that was like pretty much my only good opinion of the weekend, that and Authentic. But that goes to show you like what a great wagering opportunity the Breeders' Cup weekend is that you can be wrong about a hell of a lot of races. And I sure was. If you have one good opinion or one or two good opinions, you can still have a good weekend. And that was the case for me with Audaria. I thought, you know, like I said, I thought she was the now horse, but I thought agree 100% with Al, what a great ride that was. But I thought the key was getting her off the inside in the stretch and giving her a shot to run down Rushing Fall, because like I said, I saw her race in the Prix de l'Opéra and I thought that she was just didn't like being down towards the rail and still ran a terrific race. Got a little bit lucky there because I thought she was going to hang, but managed to dive in the last few strides and get Rushing Fall, who again just shows up every single time. So hopefully some of you guys cashed on that. We had a couple other good opinions. John had Mother Earth, the big long shot 22-1 runner up in the juvenile Phillies turf. Bill was all over Essential Quality. Brian mentioned Glass Slippers in the turf sprint. And Al had Whitmore in 2019. So everyone.
one minor thing. I did tout Valiance as a possible upset chance in the distaff.
All right, we'll give you that exacta.
Okay.
You can ride on my coattails on that one, the Monomoy Girl Valiance, Al. That'll
get you out for the weekend.
We love you, Al. We love you.
Thanks. I mean, here's one observation. If you're wrong on all 14 races, you win nothing. Just take that.
You get the dunce cap. You have the Derby contest crown and the dunce cap. You can have both. But no, I mean, it was a hard weekend to make money because it was, I think a lot of people make money at the races when there's like 8-1, 10-1, 12-1 shots. But this was one of those days where it seemed like it was either total chalk or huge bombs. And that's unless you're like leaning on one of those chalks and just going all on the other races, that makes it a little bit tough to make money. So I was thankful that Audaria was able to get up and make my weekend, but good job to everybody for their insights last week. I thought we did provide a valuable 90-minute service to the people, and it was great talking about it with you guys. And geez, only 361 days till next year's Breeders' Cup. Just got to find something to talk about in the meantime.
That is my favorite show of the year. Last week's show and this week's show are my two favorites of the year personally, because it's just there's so much talent that comes together you know, in the races, and there's so many horses that you can follow and bet, and so many stories to listen to and think about, and you know, guys getting off their schneid and you know, first timers winning, and you know, like Al said, sire, you know, horse that won the race and then is now siring foals that are winning races. It's really fun. It's what makes this industry, you know, enjoyable, or days like that.
Yeah, I mean, and the international participation was great too. I mean, I thought that might be a little subdued this year with the COVID stuff, but you know, we had a ton of participation from the Euros and a couple of wins as well, and that's what spices up the Breeders' Cup most for me, is those clash of continent battles, and we had some good ones over the weekend, and it's, you know, it was. You had the chance to make some money if you had the right opinion, but it was not easy. And that's kind of what we want. We want it to be a challenge. And we obviously look forward to next year's Breeders' Cup at Del Mar, but ton to be decided until then. And, you know, we're looking forward to the fall as well. We still have, you know, Cigar Mile Day at Aqueduct. We still have the Thanksgiving Clark weekend at Churchill. We have Santa Anita opening day after Christmas, and then the Pegasus. So there'll still be stuff to look forward to. But yeah, Breeders' Cup was kind of just a great exhale for everybody that's been working on horses all year, and we're happy for everybody who was able to get successful over the weekend.
And there are going to always be more indictments.
Yeah. Yeah. Who else are we going to lead out in cuffs? That's what I'm looking forward to the most.
Actually, Bill wrote a really fun piece. Not fun. Excuse me. Bill wrote a
great it was a blast.
It was really enjoyable. No, but it was well done. It was like old school. You talk about an old man. It was old school detective work and reporting by you, Mr. Finley.
Well, thank you. And I've never thought anybody would describe that as fun. But while we're on the subject, just to bring people up to speed, there was what was called a superseding indictment handed down last week in the Service Navarro et al. Case. And there were two very interesting developments in it. One potentially could mean major trouble for Jason Service. If you remember the original indictment, he was only charged on one count of misbranding and drug alteration, which carried a maximum sentence of 5 years. New indictment came out and they added mail fraud, wire fraud, which I've never understood. It seems like spitting on the sidewalk is mail fraud. I mean, you could get somebody for almost anything for mail fraud. But the significant part about that is that sentence is 20 years. So he went from looking at a maximum sentence of 5 years to now 25 years in prison. The other significant part was five people named in the original indictment. Their names were not included in the superseding indictment, which means only one of two things. The government decided they didn't have a case against them, which is very, very unlikely, or the more likely scenario that they are cooperating with the government. So the vice on Jason Service got a lot tighter last week, and where he goes from here, I don't know. But if you look at the history of these things and what the legal experts write, if your case goes to trial, you are like 99% sure to get convicted when the federal government goes after you. So I would imagine at some point in time, we'll see a plea bargain for him and he'll spend some time in jail. It won't be 25 years. But Mr. Service right now, I would think has to be very uncomfortable about his situation.
But no, that was great reporting by Bill. And yeah, I think there's clearly some other shoes to drop there. It's been a minute since those indictments first dropped, but Bill's on the case. And we're thankful for that because we do want to see a conclusion of this and then, you know, what might stem from it going forward.
One thing that was also interesting about that is that they came up with no new charges against Navarro. So it seems right now that they're, you know, well, they're not going to let Navarro off the hook. Seems like their emphasis right now is on Service, which I found that a little bit surprising that they didn't come up with anything new on Navarro. Again, that doesn't mean he's out of trouble, but right now, Mr. Service is in a heck of a lot of more trouble than Mr. Navarro.
Maybe Navarro figured out how not to text his his plans for breaking federal law to all of his friends. The New York Racetrack Chaplaincy Christmas Drive is now underway. Big help to the backstretch communities of Belmont and Aqueduct. Learn why you should consider sponsoring a family for this Christmas.
In my time around the backstretch, it's been apparent to me that the backstretch chaplaincy is really part of the backbone of the racetrack and what they do for people, the care. There are no bounds, no limits to what they will do for the people of the backstretch in terms of improving their quality of life. And I fully intend to support their Christmas charity and their pledge and to support a family.
TDN Writers Room is sponsored by West Point Thoroughbreds. Owning multiple graded stakes winning racehorses like Hard Not to Love and Decorated Invader is attainable with a racing partnership like West Point Thoroughbreds. Partnerships enable you to spread your ownership across several horses for less than it costs to own one horse alone. This increases your racetrack action and chances for a big horse. Learn more about why West Point Thoroughbreds is the gold standard in racing partnerships at westpointtb.com. All right, so we didn't just have news on the racetrack over this weekend in Kentucky. There was the Facing Tip in November, Night of the Stars sale on Sunday. Also, Keeneland November going on as well this week. Power-packed group of mares selling on Sunday at Newtown Paddocks, headlined by a Monomoy Girl who sold for $9.5 million to Spendthrift. Sprint Thrift was just on an insane buying spree all night. And it just seems like they're ever expanding now with the success of Into Mischief. They're ever expanding their footprint in the breeding industry. They also bought several other horses. They bought Bast for $4.2 million. They bought Got Stormy for $2.75 million. Got Stormy and Monomoy Girl are going to go back to the races as six-year-olds, their respective trainers. Midnight Bizou sold for $5 million to Chuck Allen, who's one of the partners on Midnight Bizou. He bought out the other partners. Rushing Fall went for $5.5 million to Coolmore. So it was a wild night. And I want to just give a shout out to Christy DeBernardis, Brian DiDonato, and Jessica Martini, who were on the scene and did great job covering the sale. It's a hectic night. And everybody at the TDN who did such a good job over the weekend with the Breeders' Cup and facing November. But I wanted to toss it to John and then Al to get their impressions of just an absolute star-studded night in the auction ring.
Yeah, Joe, it was great to see not only the fireworks of all the horses that were being sold. I believe there were almost two dozen horses that sold for seven figures or more at the Night of the Stars at Fasig. But what was really, exciting for the sport is that a couple of the really big expensive horses that sold, Got Stormy and Monomoy Girl, are going to be returning for racing for next year. And that just is great for racing and great for the industry overall. Obviously, it's great for Brad Cox and Mark Cassie, respectively, because they were going to re-inherit their respective horses, their respective fillies, which is a great deal. And, Fasig does a really nice job of setting up this Night of the Stars for their broodmares. Again, almost two dozen horses sold for over $1 million, the majority of which, if not all of them, were breeding stock. That shows you that they have such a good niche market of promoting those race fillies, especially coming out of the Breeders' Cup races. They just do a very, very nice job. And as far as the roster of buyers, I think you nailed the majority of them. Spendthrift, went out and bought a tremendous number of top racing fillies and recently retired fillies, to breed Into Mischief and the likes of their top stallions. And then there were a couple other ones that I thought were of note. Peter Brandt, through his White Birch Farm, bought a couple of seven-figure horses. And then there were also some horses that were purchased by Yoshida. And I'm assuming they're going to go back to Japan and fall, be bred and fall out there as well. It looked like that he was primarily buying mares that were already pregnant, so that way he can get a quicker return on investment. But it was the who's who of horses, of fillies, and the who's who of buyers at that Fasig sale.
And I think like Boyd Browning said the other night after the Fasig sale, that if you had told him beforehand that they would sell all those horses for seven figures and have gross receipts in excess of $80 million, $15 million higher than last year, with an average that was up by something around 6% and a median price up by 50%, I think he would have signed off on that a long time ago. And there's one caveat with breeding stock sales, and that is you never know what the crop is going to be. So for a yearling sale, you have the crop of 2020 that's going to sell. But for breeding stock sales, you have a collection of mares that have accomplished this on the racetrack, which may be more than what the collective group did last year. So for me, I've always seen side-by-side comparisons as sort of difficult to make. However, in the world we're living in right now, to sell, to see those horses sell for that much money, Monomoy for 9.5 and Rushing Fall. And let's not forget Keeneland. Keeneland sold Concrete Rose the other day for $1,950,000. And, the participation has come from everywhere. Again, given the global situation, you couldn't take for granted that there'd be international participation, but Coolmore has been active and prominent. And like John said, the Japanese have been prominent, as they are every year. They take these horses home. In the case that they're in fold, fold them out. Some get put through the sale there. And they oftentimes recoup a lot of that investment when they do that. And then others will be bred to top Japanese stallions. There was even a bid the other day at Keeneland. I think it was $1.6 million over the internet. So, regardless of your feelings about internet bidding, it's something that's here to stay. And $1.6 million sale on the internet's a great feather in the cap of Keeneland. But You know, breeding stock sales are fun because we recognize the horses by and large, and we have something to sort of quantify their purchase price with. And you know, it's been fun to watch. And Joe, you were too modest. I'm going to give you credit for being on the job until 3 a.m. Sunday morning, putting out an excellent newsletter. So good job on you, man.
Thank you. I appreciate it. That's why I get mad when John tries to take credit for the TDN's work. But no, I mean, no, it was, you know, this weekend, for people who don't know, is, I mean, it's a hellacious weekend in terms of workload, but, you know, we're passionate about it. So we're happy to put in the hours, but it will be nice, you know, in the next couple of weeks ago to get some downtime before the racing picks back up in the spring. So just, and again, a shout out to everybody at the TDM for all their hard work and all year, but especially in the past week. But you guys touched on all the main points. I think it really is cool to see these horses that we recognize in the ring. And I think it's nice, like when they're let out and everybody does a round of applause. I think that's very cool because the horse doesn't care if you cheer for them, but it's just a nice kind of appreciative recognition of appreciation of these top mares, and it's great to see them on the track. It's great to see them in the ring, and you know it was a great night at Facig, and Keeneland's been great so far as well. So yeah, lots to enjoy this past weekend, both in the ring and on the track. We look forward to the rest of the Keeneland November sale as well. Joining a West Point Thoroughbreds partnership can vault you into the world of instant camaraderie among people surrounding high-class horses and stakes action for a fraction of the cost of trying to do it on your own. Learn more at westpointtb.com. The Green Group Guest of the Week is sponsored by The Green Group, an accounting, tax, consulting, and advisory firm specializing in the thoroughbred industry. With over 500 clients in the horse business, they have proven strategies to save you taxes. Learn more about how they can help you at www.greenco.com. So our Green Group Guest of the Week this week is the hottest trainer in America, 4 Breeders' Cup wins over the weekend. Brad Cox, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me on, Joe.
Great to have you. So I'll start with a kind of a broader question, because you're a guy who's been known as an up-and-coming trainer for a little while, but you've broken out fairly recently. If I'm not mistaken, your first grade one win was 2.5 years ago with Mon and White Girl in the Ashland. But now you're leading the country in graded stakes wins, and you just won 4 Breeders' Cup races, like I said. How would you describe the past 5 years, and what's made the difference for your barn to reach this level?
Well, it's obviously the quality of horse. I mean, you know, I felt like we've always, you know, been able to win races. You know, obviously in the beginning was the claiming level and, you know, some allowance horses and some small stakes sprinkled in here or there. But, you know, the bulk of the stable for several years was made up of claiming horses. You know, we had a couple year run with Midwest Thoroughbreds, which was for me and my career was very educational, you know, claiming lots of horses, running, you know, may claim 2 or 3 horses a day, maybe running 3 or 4 a day. So, you know, just had the opportunity to see a lot, you know, a lot of different types of horses. But over really to answer your question, over the last 5 years, I think the biggest thing without a doubt is the clientele and the horses is the biggest change for sure.
Hey, Brad, it's Bill Finley, and thanks for joining us. And a lot of questions now about what's next for your stars from a Breeders' Cup Day. And I'll stick with the most obvious one with Mon and White Girl. You got double dose of good news during the week. She wins the Breeders' Cup and then is sold and returns to your barn. Have you had any talks yet with the Spendthrift people about how she might be campaigned going forward? And specifically, I was wondering if they may want to try something more outside the box, like some of the big races for males. We saw Midnight Bisou go to Saudi Arabia last year. There's the Pegasus, there's Dubai. But, you know, if you could just fill us in on, and I know it's a little early in the game, but, you know, what at this point have you guys talked about what might be her 6-year-old racing campaign?
Bill, honestly, I wish I had could give you a little more info there, but other than just them asking me, you know, if I'd be interested in taking her back, which was, you know, a no-brainer, and campaigning her in 2021. And that's basically the extent of our conversation. I think as, you know, she's back here with us at Churchill. She came out of the race in fantastic shape. I mean, obviously these guys vetted her at, you know, Sunday. But I think we'll find out more. They're still buying horses, it seemed like, at Keeneland, and that they seem to be busy. And obviously they've retired Authentic, and I'm sure they're sorting out, you know, see, you know, readings to him as well. So, you know, honestly, we haven't talked about a campaign and where it may start, but, you know, I totally think that, you know, facing the boys or, you know, racing internationally could be something that, that would be, could be on their mind and something that, you know, we would obviously be up for, to say the least.
Brad, it was just a phenomenal weekend for you. Again, congratulations for the four Breeders' Cup wins. I mean, has that sunk in yet? That's just astonishing. And that wasn't my real question. That was a loaded question. My real question is, of the four that I saw personally, the one that really impressed me the most was Nick's Go. I mean, here's a horse that you took over, and the horse always showed speed but was never able to carry it before. And it just seems like ever since it's been in your barn, the past, you know, three or four races you've had it, he has just clicked on every single quarter and just gone fast and fast and fast. What is the difference between, you know, Nick's Go last year to what you've done with him this year, setting a new track record, winning the mile race?
Well, I didn't have him last year. We picked this horse up last winter, right when we shipped to Oakland. Robbie Medina had him at Blackwood Farm there in Lexington training him. He's been freshened up. And in doing so, he came to us in great shape. I mean, he looked phenomenal. And he was training really, really forward, you know, to look down and see that he had a second level allowance was very encouraging, because I thought, you know, if this horse trains this way, he's going to show up and run big in a two other than at Oaklawn. And it was a good group of horses that he beat that day. It was a two other than, I think, optional 40 or 50. And it was a very, very good looking group of horses. Joe Talamo rode him that day, and, you know, he broke on top, showed the way and kept going. And, you know, he gave us a lot of confidence and thought, you know, this could be an Oaklawn, this could be like an Oaklawn handicap horse. He was training, breezed a couple times, had come up off right front. It actually took us a few days to figure out what the issue was. Minor surgery, nothing major. They talks of retiring him. I'm going to talk with June Park. I said, hey, you know, it's kind of a odd time to retire a horse. Maybe we can bring him back, you know, and give him the opportunity to, you know, see. And they did. They sent him back to Blackwood, to Robbie Medina. I did a fantastic job with him. We brought him back, and it all worked out. He returned and was as good as he was before. So, you know, he's a horse that touts you of the mornings for sure, and lets you know when he's ready to run, because, you know, he does put a lot into his training.
Hey, Brad, Alan Carafa, congratulations on a giant weekend.
Hey, Alan, thank you.
So by my count, 28 graded winners this year, 7 group grade one winners. Mm-hmm. You'll go past the 200 winner mark again for the season. I'm curious if you feel any more pressure training for Godolphin, training for Judmont, and you've had success for Judmont, Juliet Foxtrot, and Bonnie South, and unfortunately the sad news with Taraz earlier in the year. But do you feel any pressure training for guys like Sheikh Mohammed and Khaled Abdullah?
No, actually, I mean, you know, those are obviously world, you know, those guys are international stables, I should say. I guess that was the word I was looking for, international. And, you know, they just want to be told exactly what's going on, the truth with each and every horse. I mean, you know, there may be a horse that has, you know, a stellar pedigree, but if it's not doing what they're, you know, showing up and training the way they want to know. And, you know, I think they definitely want, you know, all the information, and we try to provide them with that. So, you know, they take bad news extremely well. And I think that really is what it comes down to, as far as your relationship with a client is just, you know, they can't all run. I mean, or they're not all gifted horses or graded horses, I should say. So, you know, when you have one that may not be, you know, stacking up or holding its own, you know, they're all about, you know, let's, you know, breed it, moving on to the breeding shed or, you know, whatever needs to happen as far as finding its next career, if it's not a racehorse. So honestly, no, I don't feel any added pressure with those outfits at all.
I wanted to ask about Aunt Pearl, who was obviously incredibly impressive in the juvenile Phillies turf. She's done nothing wrong so far in three starts. But she was a Tattersall's October by Liz Crow, 280,000 guineas. BSW Bloodstock has obviously been branching out into buying European horses, mostly for Chad Brown, but now one for you. I'm wondering how you got involved with that venture and whether or not you see yourself training more European bred horses in the future.
Well, I hope to. This one worked out really well. She was the most expensive purchase they had out of the TAT sales last year. I had an opportunity to go down to Paul Sharp's this winter and look at those, the group of yearlings they bought. The ownership group divvied them up between a few trainers, myself, Chad. I think there was I'm not sure if someone else got a few of them or not. I think there was maybe Brittany Trimble or someone, but anyway, we ended up with a couple others, two of them have yet to make the races. So, you know, they don't all work out, right? But this one obviously did, and she jumped from the get go. As soon as she shipped into Keeneland, she showed a tremendous amount of speed on the dirt. And you know, we thought we had something special. We actually only worked her once from the gate. It's kind of a unwritten rule of ours to work them twice. Just given the fact, you know, when you're in a first timer, you want to be, ready to pop out there, but she only needed it once, and we expected her to break extremely sharp first time. And she did. She's just very fast filly. And, you know, from what I've read about the stallion and what little I know about newspaper record, you know, she obviously has speed, and that seems to be that stallion's go-to is, you know, to the front and middle distances.
Hey, Brad, let's get on to another one of your big stars of the weekend and essential quality. I talked about him early in the show, and I gave the opinion there's nothing not to like about this horse. He's obviously got ability. He's beautifully bred. The connections are as good as you get with yourself and Godolphin. So, a lot can happen between now and the first Saturday of May 2021, but how optimistic, confident, excited are you about him going forward? And also, same question, has any talk been had yet about his three-year-old campaign? I'd imagine Oakland Park would be a pretty likely spot for him and those preps there because you're stable down there. But if you could just pick it up and give us the latest on essential quality.
Yeah, he came out of the race really, really well. We took him back to the track this morning, just jogged him. And, you know, he's a two-year-old colt. I mean, he's full of himself at times. He's a tappet. You know, he has a lot of energy. But, he seems to know, you know, when to shut it off, turn it on and shut it off, which is, I think, a great trait or quality of a class horse. He's a very nice colt. I mean, I've said it for a while now, and you know, I do think the sky's the limit with this horse, and I don't think there's any type of distant limitation with him. He doesn't really seem to he's never stressed after any of his works or races, or you know, just like he couldn't handle it. It really doesn't seem to be a bottom to him as far as stamina goes, so very optimistic that he'd be a horse that could get a mile and a quarter. As far as where we're going to land this winter, I probably will start training at some point early December at the fairgrounds. I'm not saying that's where he'll land as far as a race goes, but I think that's where his winter destination will be. And, you know, it'd be nice to get a couple races into him at some point, maybe February, March, or April. And then hopefully, you know, he does enough to earn himself a spot in the Derby in May.
Brad, I want to flip back to Monomoy Girl for a second, only because, you know, she had such a long layoff and it must have been a just tremendous training job to get her back off of a almost a year and a half long layoff to you know, get her back to the races and to the level that she has that she has aspired to now. We talked a lot about her on the show. The first race back in May when she won, kind of knocking off the rust. The second race, the Ruffian, and then working her way back up all the way up to becoming a champion again. At what point in time did you know she was back?
Probably the Ruffian. She was doing really well. I kind of leading up to the Ruffian, I was kind of mixed on whether I should ship her or fly her to Belmont. If I flew her up, I think I had to go. We had to go up like 10 days prior to the race. And if I was going to ship her up, I could have had her last work at Churchill. I opted to fly her up, breeze her once at Belmont on the main track, and Javier Castellano actually breezed her, and she breezed really well. And, you know, I felt like going into that race, we had her as good as we could get her, and she responded well. In the Ruffian, she received some really big figures. I mean, I'm a numbers guy, and, you know, the numbers come back right for me to think, you know, look, she's maybe better than she was as a three-year-old. And then just to watch her come back to Churchill and train well, lead up to the La Troyenne, That's what I was like, you know, this filly is better. She really is better than she was at three. And, you know, horses are supposed to get better as they get older. I mean, I don't think we see that. You know, it goes exactly back to Nick's go. I mean, why is he faster? He's older. He's supposed to be faster at three and four and five as he was at two. That's what, you know, the progression of a horse it does. They're bigger, they're stronger, they're faster, bottom line. It was neat to watch her really move forward and be a better horse at five than she was at three. And you got to keep in mind too, it's not as if this filly as a 4-year old just didn't train. I mean, we had her close to being back in the races twice. And you know, she had her setbacks. So, you know, it wasn't as if, you know, there was a year of her just not training. You know, she had some foundation stuff in her from a 4-year old training sessions, I guess you would say.
I want to go back to Aunt Pearl. We talked about Monomo Girl in the context of maybe traveling her overseas next year. There are a couple opportunities for a filly like Aunt Pearl, Newmarket, Epsom. Is that something that's on your radar? And ultimately, how far do you think she wants to go?
You know, I guess that's a good question, because I think anytime a horse has as much speed as she does, you kind of question how far they want to go, right? So, I mean, we've checked off a mile on the 16th in the Jessamine. We checked off a mile, obviously, in the Breeders' Cup. So, you know, we feel comfortable there. But her gallop out has always been impressive. And they say if you dig into the pedigree that, you know, it's kind of a mile and eighth, mile and a quarter pedigree on the bottom side. I think maybe a Chamardal mare. I'm not sure exactly what it is, but
Hurricane Run.
Sorry. Okay. I think Chamardal somewhere in there. I'm not exact, or maybe, I don't know.
Right. He's the sire of Lope de Vega.
So yeah, sorry. Lope de Vega. Exactly. So, you know, there's been people tell me that, you know, there's possibility she could get the mile and eighth, the mile and a quarter. I would give her an opportunity at a mile and an eighth. I mean, you know, she's, you know, obviously fast, but you know, her gallop outs have been impressive in her races. And, you know, she really shut off extremely well the other day in the, Breeders' Cup. Florent, you know, did send her out of there and establish position. And then he said, when we turned up the backside, he said, you know, I just kind of dropped my hands a little bit on it. And he said, she threw her ears up and she was just galloping. And then obviously, you know, I had a couple of people tell me they thought the second quarter of the race, there's no possible way she went that slow, but I don't know. I mean, she really shut off nicely. And I think that's basically where the race was won for sure.
And of course, Royal Ascot is obviously in the mix with a straight mile or Ronda Bend, actually. But just to further the pedigree, under her fourth dam, for what it's worth, is Monsoon, who's a tremendous staying influence, sire of a couple of Melbourne Cup winners. So, but I guess, you know, just sort of live and learn and experiment and see where she takes you.
Yeah, it would be nice to get a start into her this spring. And then, you know, maybe look at Ascot with her, you know, maybe a similar campaign that Sharing had, or I mean, obviously Sharing ended up going over there, but that was definitely something that I kind of thought about after she won the Jessamine, just given the fact, one, her pedigree, and two, no Lasix, you know, I think it's, you know, a benefit. It's going to help our horses going internationally now, as far as on the turf with the no Lasix on the 2-year-olds, which I think is a positive thing for sure.
Brad, one of the things that we ask a lot of the trainers is if they could change something in the industry to make it better, what would it be? And some of the trainers have mentioned medication policy. Some of them have mentioned, you know, running 2-year-olds less. There's a whole bunch of, we've gotten some great answers. What would you do if you could be czar of racing for a day?
Right now, it would be the Lasix thing with the young horse. I don't like how we're getting ready to branch out of Kentucky and go to some other jurisdictions that's going to offer Lasix. I mean, if we're obviously Kentucky's home base for me, and I do race in New York and I do race in Indiana where they allow it. I would like for them to completely do away with it if that's the case in these major jurisdictions. You know, I think in the long haul, I just don't know how it makes sense when they say it's going to be graded stakes for 3-year-olds are not going to be able to race on Lasix, but you know, in a maiden race a month before, you're going to be able to give it. So, I mean, I don't know if that's beneficial. It's not right for the horse. I mean, if they're going to do away with it, they should, but I understand, you know, at some point we have to have our 3-year-olds run against our older horses. So it's a work in progress, but I think we're on the right track anyway.
All right. Well, thank you so much for the time, Brad. Congratulations on the big weekend, the Breeders' Cup, and getting Monomoy Girl back. I don't know which one you're more excited about, but All in all, it seems like a pretty successful weekend. So thanks for the time, Brad. Good to talk to you.
Hi, guys. Thanks for having me.
Thanks. Great job.
Thank you.
Thanks. The Green Group Guest of the Week is sponsored by The Green Group, an accounting, tax consulting, and advisory firm specializing in the thoroughbred industry. As this week's Green Group Guest of the Week, Brad Cox will receive a free one-hour tax consultation. Learn more at greenco.com. We'll be right back after this message from The Green Group.
The Green Group is widely recognized as the top-rated tax and accounting firm specializing in the horse business. Why do the top owners, breeders, pinhookers, and trainers trust The Green Group as their tax advisors? The difference is experience. Firm founder Len Green has over four decades of experience owning, breeding, and racing horses. First-hand knowledge gives Green Group clients proven tax and money-saving strategies. Visit The Green Group at www.greenco.com. The Green Group, proven strategies to save you taxes.
All right, so that's going to do it for this week's edition of the TDN Writers Room presented by Keeneland. Remember, the Keeneland November sale runs through next Wednesday, November 18th. I want to thank Bill Finley, John Green, Alan Carrasso, our Green Group Guest of the Week, Brad Cox, our producer, Patty Wolf, and our editors, Danny Seiper and Ali LaRocca. Thanks for watching. Wear a mask. We'll see you next week.